Yeah. Hi, Mark. Over the next 20, 25 minutes, we're going to go back and look at the history of the unemployed in Toronto, almost dating back about 1895 to just before the Second World War. And we're just going to touch on a few stories because there's actually a long history in our neighborhood in East Downtown Toronto of the unemployed organizing. And what I'm going to try and do is take people here through some of that period and stuff in terms of some of the issues that people were fighting around. Before I start, I just have to set the stage here. One of the most important agencies in the area at the time was called the House of Industry, which is the Toronto's first poorhouse. It was built in 1837, was in our area for about 10 years, and then moved over to the ward in 1847. One of the things they did in 1895 is they introduced a work test, which was they made the men crack stone or break stone in order to get their relief. They had a work test before that, but they felt that wasn't enough of a deterrent, so they decided to do that. And they argued that this was a great way to deter, in particular, the unemployed, but also married men from applying for relief. What happened is, as a result of that, there was actually resistance to this new work test. And what I'm going to read right now is a letter that appeared in the Star on February 15th, 1909. It's signed out of work, so an unemployed man who wrote a letter to the Star after the Star had done a piece on the labor test. The letter is quite interesting. It gives you a really good sense of how the house industry worked and what the unemployed might have felt around the work test. So here we go. The letter reads, "The city claims to be so very religious. You have a savage way of treating poor fellows that have nowhere to go. The statement that some of the men refuse to work has appeared in the whole of the Canadian press from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But nobody ever asks why such a large percentage of the men refuse to work. No, they are simply put down as lazy. Now, when a man goes to a place like the House of Industry, it is plain that he is half-starved already. There he gets bread and some warm water, called tea, at night and in the morning. Most likely he will not get a bed the first three nights, but will sleep on the floor, with hardly any room to turn. When he gets up in the morning, after what little sleep he had been able to get, he is required to break a lot of stones. The quantity of stones to be broken will take a man used to it 3 hours, but a man not used to that kind of work will take from 4 to 6 hours. 6 hours hard work for a little bit of bread and the rest of the floor, and we sing, 'Britons never shall be slaves.' Let the people of Toronto reflect a little on the conditions in this city and cease casting slurs upon those who are, for the time being, in bad circumstances." The letter is fascinating because it actually talks about the conditions of the House of Industry, and it's clear that there's objection to this work test in terms of how cruel it is, in terms of making men, as he says, who are already half-starved, break stone for the food. So there's objection to that. So you can find throughout that period people who are actually organizing against the work tests. On February 5th, 1915, there's another article that appeared in the section, the court section. It's the story of George Buss, unemployed man, 35 years old, who refused to break stone at the House of Industry. And as a result, he found himself in front of a magistrate. And this is the interaction between George Buss and the magistrate at the time. The story begins, Constable McBurney stated in prosecution that Buss had been getting his meals free at the House of Industry and had refused to work for them. That is crack stone. "That is correct," Buss said with a defiant air. "Oh, I see. You are one of those who has come to the conclusion that somebody has to support you," said Squire Ellis. "Oh, yes," said Buss, who had a sullen expression on his face. "Did you refuse to crack stone for your meals?" "Yes, and there's lots like me." "And do you sleep at the police stations?" "Yes, with hundreds of others." "Have you hunted for work?" "I certainly have." "Yet you refuse to work for food?" continued the squire. "That's one way of looking at it, your way." "Well, I think you need looking after," said the worship. "It'll be $20 or 90 days in jail." And what's fascinating here is here you have an unemployed man who is in front of a judge who's about to go to jail. was very confrontational in terms of his attitude. But more importantly, he's actually telling you that he's not alone, that there are many like him who feel this way. There's a kind of consciousness there in terms of the situation that they find themselves in terms of the fact that if they don't have work, that the state owes them relief, and that it's not a situation where they're lazy and don't want to work. They literally want to work. So the story is very fascinating in terms of that. So one of the fights, one of the big fights that was going on during this period, again, was around the work test. The unemployed were all the way from 1895, actually all the way up to before the Second World War. And by 1925, the unemployed were actually calling for an end to the work tests. But the other big fight that was happening was a fight for free speech in the city. And probably it came to a head on August 13th, 1929. Prior to that, the communists were trying to organize in the city. They were having problems getting a hold of halls and that kind of stuff. So they organized on street corners, like Queen and Spadina, Dundas and Spadina was the main drag where they used to go. That was Tim Buck and some of the others that were around back then. And often they were chased out the corner, and sometimes they were like brutally beaten back. But what happened October 13th, 1929, is about 5,000 people gathered, and they tried to enter Queen's Park. There was a big gazebo there, and they were going to try and speak in the gazebo. The minute that the leaders began to make their move towards the gazebo, there was a police riot, essentially. The police, for the next few hours, actually beat back many of the demonstrators that were there. Not just the demonstrators, but also people who just happened to be in the area.
Sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar. And this is someone who was there, actually. After that night, actually, a lot of people went back to some of the labor temple and actually talked about what had happened. And this is one of the comments that was made about what happened that night. This is Thomas Leader talking. He says, "Gentlemen, I have just come from a slaughter." This is Tom Leader as he addressed a meeting at the Else Court Labor Party after the Queen's Park riot. "It was the most brutal, inhumane sample of official violence and the most sordid exhibition of police methods ever heard of. It was unthinkable, awful. I had not dreamed that such things could go on in Toronto." They really, really, literally beat the crap out of people. And actually, some of the newspaper, the Star, or the Daily Star at the time, were actually very, very critical of the police in terms of that night. Some of the others not as critical. So the question you want to ask is why this amount of repression? Why, what was the city so scared of? Why were the cops used to repress this large gathering? And by the way, they actually again a week later decided to have to meet again to try to go to Queen's Park. Another 5,000 people actually came. This time they didn't try and enter the park and just walk south instead of going to Queen's Park. But in order to understand what was going on there, there's a person, the commissioner, the police commissioner, was Judge Coatsworth, who was a very anti-red person. And he gives you an understanding of what was going on back then in the city in terms of why this stuff was going on. The city had a great, great fear that the unemployed were being organized inside and they were being incited by the communists. Now, you have to understand, this incident actually happened just a few months before the great crash, right, the 1929.
Yeah.
So a lot was going on before then. Unemployment was high. And this is what Judge Coatsworth had to say. He says, "In Toronto, the capital of the province, they, the communists, are endeavoring in every way to spread their evil doctrines. The communists are not just a mere handful of propagandists to be ignored, but a real menace to be put down with the strongest action possible. These people are foreigners who have left their own countries and have come to seek to abolish existing institutions. Those who think that this is simply an agitation for free speech are entirely mistaken. Speaking for myself, I intend to do everything possible to combat this dangerous element. They already have a serious foothold in Toronto and are trying to establish themselves in other cities." So there was a great fear in the city that you have to understand that Toronto for a long time it had always attracted a large number of unemployed. And actually, even as far back as the 1890s, Toronto was described as the headquarters of vagrants and tramps who used to come to the city during the winter because they had no work for that kind of stuff. So it has that long history, except here now you have a situation in 1929, the summer of 1929, where the hostels are packed. There are thousands of men who have no work, and they're being organized, and that was the threat. And for them, for the police and the city, they knew that they had to get rid of these people. They had to squash this, and the whole fight for free speech, which I won't talk about later on, but it actually resurfaced again in Allen Gardens in the summer of 1933, where I think it was 2,000 ex-soldiers actually organized in Allen Gardens, tried to meet, had a banner that said "Heroes 1914, Bums 1933." And there was a big, big battle that happened for two, three hours. They're chased out. Except for the next month, they vowed to come back, and eventually they broke the back of the city, and the city was forced to allow, people to go to gather in parks and to talk about what was going on in employment and stuff.
The numbers are incredible. Thousands of people, 2,000, 5,000 people.
No. It was clear that, I mean, if I, it's funny because having organized you and I in the area now for the last, 20 years or so, when we try and work with people in the hostels and stuff, we've been able to, in terms of like large demonstrations, Queen's Park, 1,500, sometimes 2,000. But back then, they were able to do that quite regularly in terms of sometimes as many as 5,000. So there's a pretty large movement.
Yeah.
And it's also clear from what we'll see a bit later that they were well organized in terms of the kinds of things they did. So the next thing we'll talk about briefly is the other issue. So we had the issue of the work test, which is the breaking stone, people organizing around that. We had the whole issue of free speech that was going on. The other issue was around hostile conditions. There was a lot of work being done by the unemployed around hostile conditions, because at the time they were not able to get money to rent a room. And actually one of their demands actually began that they wanted like $5 a week to be able to rent a room rather than to be in hostels. So that was one of the demands that they had. But also the hostel conditions were horrific. And again, if you begin to look at why were they so horrific, why was the overcrowding so bad, and why was the city allowing to do this, there's a really, really interesting, there's a number of interesting things that happened. One of the guys that was organizing was October 1932, was a guy named William McKnight, an Irishman, who was actually organizing in the hostels, soup kitchens and stuff. He attended a meeting in October 1932 at a Church of the Ascension, and it was said there was about 350 men from Wellington House, which was one of the largest hostels in Toronto, Seton House, and some of the other city hostels. So over 350 people from hostels is a large meeting to come. Also at the meeting was this councillor, Alderman Rogers. Now, what happens is William McKnight was one of the main organizers. He eventually got arrested and was in the city, attempted to deport him as a result of his organizing in shelters and stuff. He's organizing around the food and that kind of stuff. But what's interesting is that night, I think he was arrested by the police, and on him he had a petition. And then when he was arrested, he was questioned by the police, and he said that at one point that he talked about Alderman Rogers, said that he was there at the meeting, and that Alderman Rogers was supposed to bring this petition to the Board of Controls, which is the City Hall. Now, what was interesting is when other councillors found out about this, there was a fascinating discussion that happened at City Hall, and the other councillors actually went after this Alderman Rogers. So I'll just read you a little bit of that interaction between the councillors in terms of this petition at McKnight and this meeting at the Church of Ascension, because again, there was a great fear by the city that these men were meeting, that they were being agitated by various people. And here's what was said. It says, "I think Mr. Laver should begin the instruction not to allow anyone." Now, I should start before. Mr. Laver was the commissioner, the welfare commissioner at the time, and very important person around that time. He says, so this is the mayor talking. He says, "I think Mr. Laver should be given instruction not to allow anyone to go in and talk to men unless they have a permit from him," said Mayor Stewart. "They are liable to cause trouble." Controller McBride, "There certainly shouldn't be speaking in these institutions. All they want is to be amused." And then Controller Remad and another controller says, could you ever conceive what one riot would mean, more than all we have spent? The mayor, I've done my duty in warning members of council. Council McBride, it is unfortunate that in everything that comes up, your friend Rogers is connected with this. And then this is the police speaking. It says, from our investigation, we find that there were no known communists attending the meeting, but a number of socialists were included. And then Mann and Simpson, who these were police officers who investigated the issue, they were actually from the Red Squad. And then Alderman Rogers, this is the guy who was at the meeting, says, in fairness to myself, I don't want to go out to the public that I was fomenting discontent. And then Constable Controller McBride said, if you take an old campaigner's advice, you'll keep away from such meetings. So here you have a situation where you have a city politician who is at this meeting. And now other councillors are trying to say, listen, what were you there, inciting these men? Don't you understand that this is dangerous? This is dangerous stuff to do? And the councillor having to back off a little bit, saying, you know, well, it really wasn't really my idea to go there and incite people and stuff, and trying to back off. So it's actually fascinating to see. One is that the men were organizing, but two, this great fear, that somehow by being at these meetings that the men are being incited, and that there was a great fear of riot, that this incitement would lead to riot, and assumingly because the conditions were so bad. We're talking here 1932, at the height of the Depression, which was summer of 1933, almost 30% of the people in Canada were unemployed. Many of those were in large urban centers like Toronto, Vancouver, and other places like that. The next story is from, again, that period, 1933. In July 1933, there was an article that was in the front page of the Toronto Star, and it was about the Crawford shelter. A lot of the men who were saying they were actually ex-soldiers. Now, what's fascinating is as you read the history of the unemployed in Toronto, is that many of the people were actually ex-soldiers from World War I who actually had no employment and who were actually organizing in the various communities and stuff. And the conditions in this shelter were there's 320 men that were crammed in the hostel. They slept 42 to a room and were only getting 2 meals a day. Now what happened is a delegation of those men actually went again to City Hall and gave a deputation. And what was fascinating here again is you as you'll find out, Commissioner Laver comes up in this thing. And again, Commissioner Laver was very, very important because he became the welfare commissioner and had a lot of power in the city. And actually by 1933, the welfare department had taken over all of the outdoor relief that the House of Industry had been doing for years and years and years. I think at the time in the summer of 1933, 25,000 families were getting relief. So huge, huge, huge enterprise and stuff. So he was a powerful person. So here you have these ex-soldiers who go to the city hall and they want to talk about their conditions. And this is the interaction between the men and Commissioner Laver. He says, delegation, these men complain of poor meals and overcrowding. Perhaps you don't realize that we have to handle these men so that they won't want to come back, said Laver. You mean you don't want to make a sort of home for them, the delegation said. That's it. We don't want to make too comfortable for them. What about getting 2 meals instead of 3? We are following the usual policy, 3 meals in the winter and 2 in the summer. What about the treatment in general? No, I'm satisfied that the conditions are all right, said Laver. That they are crowded, 42 to a room, the delegation said. They are large rooms, as large as the school rooms. I don't think it's too much, Laver said. What about the meals? They say that they're rotten, the delegation says. It's not generally known, but the city has not paid 1 cent towards the meals. Of the 1 million or so meals last year, the city taxpayer hasn't paid 1 cent. They come from the private sources. And the quarters, the delegation said, the beds are the same as they had at the Coliseum. Now, the Coliseum was another place that was used to house ex-soldiers. The men have signed a petition, 190 of them, so they say, and sent it to the city council about the conditions at the hostels. Laver, I don't know anything of that. I don't think they have anything to complain about. What we've tried to keep down the number down to less than 300. And in view of the recent complaints, you'll make no investigation of the Crawford hostelry? The delegation asks. No, I'm satisfied that things are as good as they can be under the circumstances. You have troubles with the human sight of relief applicants, the delegation says. We don't want to make it too comfortable for them. And then again, Laver restates that he won't look into the conditions. The headlines in the Daily Star the next day was, "Try not to make the job as comfortable," Laver says. "Handle the man so they won't want to come back." So here again, you have a policy, a very open policy, which is discriminates against this man, that says, if you make it too comfortable for these people to come to the city, they'll come. But if you make it very uncomfortable, we'll drive them out. And it's a fan. Again, it's very fascinating in terms of the interaction between the declaration. They're obviously living in really, really bad conditions. There are many, many, many stories of actually the unemployed organizing around the Wellington House, which by the 1930s was the largest hostel in Toronto. Over 600 men, actually, just not far from in East Downtown Toronto. And also the House of Industry and some others.
Not aware of that one. Wellington House?
Wellington House, yeah. It was first built in 1930. It was run privately for the first year, but then the Welfare Department took it over. And actually a lot of the organizing came out of Wellington House, actually. A lot of the conditions were... I won't talk about them today, yeah. but there's a lot of that stuff that happened. So the other story I have is again, another... William McKnight was one of the men that was organizing in the area. Another man that was organizing actually not far from here, actually used to live on Ontario Street, was an ex-soldier whose name was William Lyons. And actually William Lyons was involved in the summer of 1933 in the free speech fights. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was actually arrested that day and went to jail for 30 days. And on June 13th, 1934, Lyons, with a delegation of six men who were from the Ward 2 Unemployed Association, went to City Hall. And here, what I want to do is, this will take a little longer, there's a little bit more stuff here. I want to read in terms of the account of what happened that day as recorded by the Star and also from some of the court records. And as you'll see, the resistance was quite intense in terms of it was a very, very militant group. They were ready to fight. And so I'm just going to read some of the stuff and hopefully this will make sense to people as I read it. So here's how it starts. What is your name? The mayor asked the leader. William Lyons was the answer. And yours? Pursued the mayor. McCab was the answer. Weren't you people told not to come back here? Asked the mayor. No, came a chorus of responses. With this, the leader started to read a speech. On behalf of the Ward 2 unemployed, he began. Just a minute, put the mayor. We're not going to hear you. After much wrangling, the leader again attempted to speak. We're not going to hear you, repeated the mayor. There is the door. Are you a servant of the people or a dictator? Lyons demanded. I am a servant of the people, but I'm not going to listen to you. You are just a bunch of agitators. With this, the police stepped and the struggle ensued. What follows is a description of the struggle. Fists flew in the city council chambers, and for a time the situation looks serious when a deputation of Ward 2 unemployed stubbornly resisted efforts of officers to eject them. One man with an artificial leg seized Sergeant Dickinson by the throat and had him gasping double over the desk. Captain T. Heron, the Civic Welfare Department, came to the rescue and sent his son sprawling on the floor. Before he did so, however, another man had stepped up and smashed Dickinson in the face. Plains clothesman, man of the Red Squad, got a neck hold on another demonstrator, but had a much more difficult insomnium. The controllers stirred uneasily in their seats. Whole others scampered to safety. The unemployed received cheers and encouragements from the gallery. So you can see
what a scene.
What the scene, right? Yeah. You can see, and they're very close. I mean, they're right by the table. You know, you can see. And actually, when I read this, it's almost like I don't know if people remember the Axworthy action that happened in Montreal when about several hundred people went into and shut down the Axworthy inquiry into reforms to welfare.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar scenes in terms of people coming in, tables being turned over, and chairs, and people in the gallery cheering them and stuff. Yeah. Oh, so I'll leave it. I'll leave. You know what? We'll just leave. Yeah. As you look, you know, at some of the history of the unemployed, there are countless, numerous accounts like this of the unemployed going to the city hall, because at the time, it was city hall that was responsible for the relief of the unemployed.
So no provincial input.
No, there were very little provincial money that was coming. I mean, there was always this fight. Yeah. And at times even the funding that was coming from the province and the federal government was totally eliminated. And then, for instance, in 1935, in the summer of 1935, about 1,100 men were actually kicked out of the hostels, just put out in the streets. Actually, it's just there would have been hundreds of men just at the corner of Queen and Sherburn here, right around the corner. And at the time, the CCF was actually organized and came in and actually picked up the men. They actually, for two, three nights, they put them up in some of the clubs and stuff that was happening.
It's amazing to hear this unknown history. Yeah. We're pretty much...
Okay. I have time. I'll finish with one.
But if you,
I'll try and finish. So the last thing we'll talk about is so in the spring of 1933, the National Committee of Unemployed Council was organizing across Canada, but also in Toronto. And I'll just end by reading this quote, and hopefully I'll be able to fit on there. And this is from a pamphlet that they put out, and it was cost 5 cents a nickel at the time. And this is the preamble in terms of they had a 10-point program that they were asking for: employment insurance, abolition of work tests, etc. So here we go, and I'll end with this. It says, unemployment, want, and hunger prevails all over this rich country. Tens of thousands of working people, men, women, and children, are suffering and are on the verge of starvation because they lack sufficient food, clothing, and shelter. As the present crisis deepens and becomes more and more acute, more and more toilers are losing their jobs. Their meager savings and belongings consequently are needing relief. The huge army of destitute people increased day by day. What is the policy of the Canadian government, federal, provincial, and municipal, to this situation of hunger? It has been still and is that of slow starvation. The workers have been forced to fight for every bit of relief they receive today. For this reason, the relief is better in those parts of the country where the workers organizing have actually struggled for relief, or where the very threat of struggle has compelled the government to grant relief. These forms of actions and struggles have resulted in so much more bread, milk, clothing, self-respect for tens of thousands of unemployed and their dependents. The willingness to struggle, the determination to resist all efforts to be class and treated like outcasts and paupers have brought results of victories, no matter how small. These achievements of the organized unemployed movement have given new courage, new hope, new self-respect, and councils of men and women were plunged onto silent misery, poverty, degradation by terrible forces of hunger. And the kinds of things that they did, and I'll end again with this, the kinds of tactics that they use, and I'll just go through a list of them, just then in terms of how they organize, and they use mass demonstration, hunger marches, relief strikes, picketing of homes and office officials, mass delegations at relief offices to defend the rights of the individuals being refused relief, surrounding and occupations of homes of workers being evicted, petitions, supporting strikes of employed workers, and holding public hearings and public trials to expose the conditions of the unemployed. So they're very, very active in terms of what they did and the kinds of tactics that they were using.
That's amazing stuff.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah.